Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Dr. Olga Yurkova. Olga is a Ukrainian journalist and co-founder of StopFake.org, an independent Ukrainian organization that trains an international cohort of fact-checkers in an effort to curb propaganda and misinformation in the media. And she spoke with us last July about her work fighting Russian propaganda campaigns in Ukraine with her projects Forbidden Facts and StopFake.org. Since then, Vladimir Putin's violent invasion has ravaged the Ukrainian landscape, displacing millions of people and causing thousands of civilian casualties in just a few months' time. This is actually the third time we're having Olga on. She is a repeated guest by popular demand. Here she is now. I am so excited to be speaking with Olga Yurkova again. This will be our third conversation, and it's so nice. I feel like I've made a friend across the world just because the first time we talked, it was before the war broke out, and you were talking about how you were seeing things starting to escalate, and you were predicting there was going to be a problem. And there was a problem. And then we were speaking during the war. And I believe you had were talking about how there was a radio or a media tower that had been bombed and things were happening around you or in your town. And then we found time also to talk about this Ukrainian instrument that I had that I didn't realize was a Ukrainian instrument, the bandura, I think bandura.
That I thought
was something else. So I had been given it by someone who was just getting rid of things, and I just loved it as a piece of artwork. It was beautiful, and I just thought about all the links and my grandfather being from Romania and now a part of the world that's now Ukraine, and so just the when you get to know someone, you get to see how much your lives are woven into each other's without even realizing. And so I think that's why it's important for people to talk to people around the world to realize that we're not so different after all. And so I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself and then we'll start talking.
Yeah, my name is Olga Yurkova. I am a journalist initially. I have an experience of journalism and editing about 20 years. And in 2014, I, with my colleague, organized the fact-checking organization called StopFake.org. And it initially was just a project, initially it was just a website where we collected examples of Russian disinformation. And We checked them with our journalistic methods, like photos, videos, or other strong evidence. And now our organization is much more than just a website with this like a huge collection of Russian disinformation. Now we are well-known experts in propaganda, disinformation, fact-checking in all this sphere because of enormous experience which we live through. So we have, unfortunately, Ukraine is a testing lab for all Russian manipulation techniques, all the new concepts of disinformation. Unfortunately, due to this situation, we have unique expertise in this sphere. So we teach people around the world how to counter disinformation, how it works, etc. Yeah, and maybe it's the main, maybe it's the most important information about me. And also, a year ago, I started teaching in the university. I got PhD, and my thesis, the topic of my thesis was rumors as a social communication phenomenon. I analyzed how rumors are spread, how rumors are spread during the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Oh, that is so exciting. So I need to reintroduce you now as Dr. Yurkova. And so that is lovely. Wow. That's a
pretty
lot.
Young. Yeah. Pretty young doctor. Like,
yeah. Okay, fine. but yeah, I mean, that is quite an achievement. And I'm so happy because one of the things I was going to ask about is about how we educate people to be informed about this. And so I'm sure it's been exciting for you to not only be having this organization where you get to detect where it's happening and how it's happening, but to be able to let people know how this whole thing works and rumors and how it's very interesting about rumors. I remember when I was growing up, I learned, because I'm raised in a Jewish tradition and a Jewish religion, and there is an idea in Judaism that destroying someone's reputation is considered worse than killing them because they have to live with it. And it is something that sticks with you. Even though killing is bad and it's against the Ten Commandments, if you believe in the Ten Commandments, but still, so it's still high on the list. You know, it's not to discount killing, but the shame, the living in a way where you have to constantly fight against your reputation, the rumors, and how much they stick like glue, and they affect. It becomes, I want to find like other glasses, like it becomes like the lens, you know, that everyone sees you through. And it's hard to fight that. It's an incredible thing with rumors. So I'm so excited to be able to talk to you about that. And I guess just to start on a personal note, how you're doing with how exhausting I'm sure it all is to just have an ongoing war. And I also want to say, this is not a political discussion, even though, you know, I think we have similar politics here, but still, this is about information, how it can be used, misused, how it can cause people to turn on each other rather than being clear about who the enemy really is. I mean, it has so much power. And these kinds of conversations get right to the heart of why I called this podcast Indoctrination. I didn't call it cults only, or I don't know, relationship with narcissists only, but it's about influence, the influence of information and how unfortunately effective it is. And that sometimes the only way to fight it is to prevent it or to have people know what to watch out for. But I'm curious just about how you're doing with this whole ongoing war?
Well, not very well. You know, it's exhausting. It lasts more than 3 years now. We have a blogger who stated that this war would last about 2 or 3 weeks. And some people really hoped for this. And they were disappointed.
Right, I'm sure.
Yeah, and this is, I think that this is like the most, this is the worst thing to hope for this quick end of the situation. Yeah, quick resolution. Unfortunately, because I also would like to come to end of this war as quick as possible, but in reality, no one knows how long will it last. So I love the book by a psychologist, Viktor Frankl, who survived a Nazi concentration camp. It's very popular among Ukrainians right now. And he advised doing what we can do. So this gives our lives meaning.
I have this book right here, actually. I'm looking, Man's Search for Meaning, right? Is that the book or is there a different book that you're talking about?
Yeah.
I'm pointing. I have it on my bookshelf here. It's one of those books that's like it centers you, you know? It's very interesting that it's so popular now in Ukraine. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's a very meaningful book to me too. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's I reread it several times and because it's really, it helps keep our minds healthy, even in the worst conditions, because it's, I couldn't even imagine how it is to live during the war, but unfortunately it's our reality and we live here, so we should look for ways to not just live in these conditions but also be effective and do something. I don't know, we are, all of us are different, but all of us can do something useful for country, for ourselves, for our families, etc. So I try to live in this way.
Yeah. So, right, I think that finding meaning, finding the answer to the question, why am I here? Why is my life important? Why am I able, or how also, how am I able to help? What can I do? Asking yourself all those questions and developing an answer for it. It helps with the existential issues, the feeling of emptiness or futility, like what is the point? Find the point. It is such an important thing to do. And to know that then the thing that you care about is something you can then use to educate others is a very important thing. I'm wondering, even before we get into that, with the teaching and teaching people to look for things that help them know if they're being influenced, what caused your interest in this to even in 2014 help to start stopfake.org? What was your motivation?
I am stuck with the idea that journalism should be responsible. So for me, the speculations, interpretations, like speculative interpretations, are not journalism. It's something else. It's maybe it's politics. Maybe it's I don't know, it's gaining popularity, but it's not journalism. And for me, as a journalist, important value. One of my core values is telling truth, to inform society, to inform people properly, to inform people honestly. So for me, it's maybe it's my value. So when in 2014, me and my colleagues journalists were shocked with Russian disinformation spread by journalists, by so-called journalists. Yes, actually they are propagandists, but we perceived them as journalists. And it was a shock. We learned from them how to do some digital features or something like this. And then we realized that they just lie. They tell to the whole world about Ukrainian fascists and Nazis and about some coup d'etat allegedly occurred in Ukraine. and some junta who came to power as a result of this coup d'etat and so on. We were shocked, and it was just our natural reaction. It was, yeah, we started with my colleagues. We were alumni of one of the projects for journalists, educational projects, and we just started discussion what to do about it. And it was my idea to create a website to collect all these propaganda examples to show how it works and to make like an archive of this propaganda to explain people how it works, how to debunk it, and also to show the scale, the scope of this propaganda, that it's not just something, some like random fake news. It's a system. It's a deliberate act of disinformation conducted using Russian official media, using also private-owned media, some influencers, etc., etc. So now we have more than 8,000 debunked false news on our website, and we can also do some research of narratives behind them, of channels through which they are disseminated, etc. So my dream is to stop this work because there are no need in this. But unfortunately, the current situation the best condition for it.
No, I'm sure. I wonder about the idea of truth, because you can tell a lot about the health of a person psychologically by how much they cannot handle the truth, and also by how comfortable they are not telling the truth. You can also tell a lot about the health of a relationship, of a family system, or within a cult. Those are, if they're not healthy, they're run by someone who just wants power and influence. They don't care about the truth. I think that's why there's the expression in English, speaking truth to power, like they are at opposite sides. Sometimes you have to speak the truth, not with the power, but to the power. Like there is this thing on the other side that's this power. And speaking truth to power is, though not always safe and doesn't always make you popular. And sometimes you have to hide out. But sometimes when you speak truth, you find out about the person in the position of power. Are they interested? Do they care? Are you going to get punished for saying the truth? You can find out a lot by how much a culture, a system can tolerate truth. And also with how comfortable they are with lying. Sometimes people are given permission to lie. That happens within cults, because they think it's for the greater good, like they're doing something right. But sometimes they lie because they're told they have to, and they're afraid to not go along with their orders. I'm wondering what you think is happening here. It's probably more than just those answers. But with the amount of disinformation, the 8,000 examples that you have on your website, are these journalists thinking it's for the greater good for their country, or are they just too afraid to not say what they're told to say? What do you think it is?
I think that they are just cynical people who just gain money on this. Most of them, most of like prominent propagandists like Olga Skabeeva or Vladimir Solovyov, or like they're very well-known propagandists. They have their own TV shows, etc. But yes, there are, it's just a showcase of all this propaganda machine. And there are thousands of people who work there. And I think it's a tragic what is going on in Russian journalism, because these people work without any like values, without any orientation, what is good and what is bad. Maybe some of them are, I think, because we can see some results of sociological surveys in Russia, but I am not sure that they deserve trust, because we don't know how these surveys are conducted. But due to these results, most of Russians support policy of Russia, the imperialistic ideas of Putin, and including invasion, full scale invasion of Ukraine. So I think it's like an intersection of deep crisis in journalistic education, maybe in journalistic environment as a whole, because people, we are social animals, yeah, and we just see some role models around us or don't see them. And so I think the problem lies in the intersection of this crisis of journalism, of some fear, and I think of the desire to gain money on this, because propagandists are very well paid in Russia. There are also a lot of open information about it.
Right. Right. So, and usually the people who are fighting propaganda are not as well paid.
Unfortunately, no.
Right.
Initially, we were volunteers at all, but then we just realized that we should institutionalize our organization to apply for grants to reputable foundations. So now we try to be involved in many different projects as some institution helping to make our information environment healthier.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, yeah. Right. So I'm wondering, I know we went over a few questions ahead of time, and of course, I want you to be able to take the conversation anywhere you would like, and now that I know you're a professor, I want to be able to ask about that as well. But there's an interesting thing when we talk about Zelensky and now talking about Trump. Also, I'll say with the caveat, this is not an anti-Trump conversation. This is about pinpointing certain traits, certain facts that I think are important to highlight. And just to say that a lot of people who have been involved in cults or who have been abused by someone who is had like a malignant narcissism, very kind of a cruel person, they're very triggered by Trump. A lot of them contact me and say, he may or may not be a cult leader, but I know that person. It's all too familiar. And they have the same reaction around Putin, but not Zelensky. So you want to have this belief that people are going to feel something when they've been through something, when they have been manipulated. They're going to see that. They're going to sense that in somebody else. And here, Zelensky at some point said that Trump is living in a disinformation space created by Russian propaganda. And that's an interesting point. So I'd love you to talk about that, about Zelensky saying that, and what your thoughts are about that.
I think I would agree with with our president. Unfortunately, because some claims of Donald Trump are very strange, taking into account that the US is our long-term
ally.
Who completely understands the situation and this Russian propaganda environment. Yeah, and unfortunately today the Ukrainian authorities have to explain basic things to the new American government, and this is a big problem. And this war, we know that it has been going on for 11 years, and we have become accustomed to the fact that the US is our reliable partner, who is on the same page with us, and who respects the facts. And so there is no need to explain who attacked whom, for example.
Right. Well, it shouldn't be necessary to explain something that obvious. But yes, go ahead.
And also, there is no need to explain how Russian propaganda works, because it, we saw this understanding in the US at the highest level. But today, the entire long history of relations and finding consensus seems to have been nullified. And everything has to start from scratch. It looks like this. I don't know. So today, Ukraine is forced to deal with debunking historical fakes created by Putin's propaganda, both at the official level and also at the public level. And Ukrainian government officials, journalists, independent analysts constantly emphasize that Russia carried out a full-scale invasion on February 24, 2022, and the war has actually been going on since 2014, when Russia occupied Crimea and began supporting militants in Donbas. And if you recall, there was not even a single plausible reason for this invasion. Russia carried out various provocations, but they were not successful, thanks to the coordinated response of the Ukrainian government and civil society. And something similar is happening today. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Office of the President, Ukrainian diplomatic missions quickly respond to such statements, such strange statements about, for example, that Ukraine should have never started the war. All the time, all of our representatives try to explain that it was unprovoked, completely unprovoked invasion. So even taking into account that Ukraine is also actively cooperating with international media experts and politicians, some politicians, and explaining that Russia is the only aggressor in this war, we see the situation when it looks like we should, I don't know, we should explain this more and more. And I'm not sure that anyone is willing to hear us. So, of course, also we, as Stop Fake fact-checking organizations, who are in, we are engaged in debunking these narratives, as well as to governmental structures in Ukraine created to counter disinformation. We have such two organizations since 2022, the Center for Strategic Communications and the Center for Countering Disinformation, many, many different state and public bodies try to explain all this situation. But the problem is, I think, that this issue is highly politicized in the United States today. So it's I think that these statements by Donald Trump and other politicians are often based not on facts, but on some political interests. So now we... Ukraine is forced to work with different bubbles, groups of influence, which really complicates the communication at all. And of course, Russia has been working for decades to create this alternative reality, alternative version of history, of reality, using the media, think tanks, social media, even politicians and different lobbyists, influencers, etc. And today, the idea of like so-called Ukraine's responsibility for the war gained influence, I think, especially among some audience inclined to isolationism in the United States. Maybe I am not right, but it looks like this from Ukraine. And of course, also Russia invests significant funds in this propaganda. And Ukraine has limited resources to constantly monitor, refute the disinformation, communicate to all these fairly like closed audience bubbles. And yeah, and let me tell some illustration of this. About a week ago, I listened to an interview with our former foreign minister Dmytro Kuleba. And he said that he gives interviews to American media all the time, but only from a so-called democratic pool. Our diplomats have repeatedly expressed their will to talk to the media that supports Trump, but they have not received any response from them. So it seems that these media are not interested in balanced information, in like other point of view. I don't know why. And I think it's a dangerous situation because it is polarizing society. But politicians often act like this. Ukrainians try to contact with different audiences in the US, but the representatives, the media, the influencers of who express this views, they are not interested in any contacts with the other side.
Right. I mean, just to not be interested in having the discussion is part of the problem now, that when there had been more diplomacy, when people could tolerate hearing opposing viewpoints and were willing to take in the information, to be open also to having it affect them, maybe change their mind, then I think things were safer. Things are safer when that happens. It's like applying the scientific model to anything where, you know, science isn't necessarily about facts that stay static throughout time. It's about coming up with an idea that's based on the information you have up until that point. And then when you have more information, you incorporate that and it changes how you see things, and being open to that process. I think that would be wonderful if politically people could also be open to that process. But I think while I think they think they're seeming like they are the tough guys, we're not going to allow, you know, a conversation with these people, with these journalists, because we know we have the facts already. You know, they think they're coming across as so powerful and strong. From a psychological perspective, I see them as lacking courage. I see them as not feeling strong enough to handle hearing what could be the truth, because it might shift their view of things, but it also might shift their feeling of superiority, which I think they might not be able to tolerate.
Yeah, it's unfortunately this like feeling of superiority is a powerful leverage to manipulate people. Because I had a lot of conversations with people from different countries, not only in Ukraine, or for example, people from China, even from China who left China. And they told me about this, about instrumentalizing of this idea of superiority, but by their governments. So I was shocked that in China, it's also, I know that it's a popular idea in Russia. to be like that Russia is like the very like the great country with a great culture, etc., etc. But the same idea is explored in different countries, and it's pretty successful, especially when the people who are manipulated are poor. They had not a lot of money. They are not happy with their lives. But so it's not like they have no reason to consider their country great, but they do. So it's like, I don't know. It's some psychological effects, and yeah, I think that I'm going to pay more attention some psychology. Maybe I will if I will if I have time, I will receive some psychological education, because it's really like very important. It explains our behavior more than logic. Unfortunately, because yeah, we at StopFake try to explain all these issues with like logical arguments, and sometimes it works for people who use these logical arguments and logic at all. But people generally are not logical beings.
No, they're highly reactive, emotional. Even though they would be the last people to admit that they're being emotional, it is helpful to have like a psychological viewpoint. It also helps, even though this is not to downplay the seriousness and the destruction that can be caused, and you know, by people who act this way in the world. I see sometimes politicians who are coming across as very polished, but based on the words they're saying, and also based on the lack of tolerance they have to take in information, and how much they will be angry at people who question them, I picture them as little children having a tantrum. It just is coming across as a sophisticated thing because they're wearing a suit and they have a microphone and they have a position of power, but they're, to me, little children. I might not say that to their face, but I will know it. There's also two other psychological terms that I think about a lot with these governments that we're talking about. And also, I think probably with some of the propaganda, which is the gaslighting, right? Just really reinventing people's histories, people's sense of what's real and what's not. And also, there's a woman who... whose name is Jennifer Freid, who I actually quote quite a bit. She came up with a term, DARVO, D-A-R-V-O, which is something you were mentioning before. And it's a handy term because it comes out of people who want to protect themselves from being seen as the aggressor. They want to get away with things. So abusers, gaslighters, will often use DARVO. And what it stands for, the initials are, the D is for deny. I never said that. No, I didn't. That wasn't me. You're imagining it, right? And then attack. And you are never to question me again. And I'm going to have you arrested or deported. And then the RVO stands for reverse victim and offender. So, like, how Ukraine is not the victim in the story. They're the offender. They're the attackers, right? Total turnaround. And it is usually so extreme that it makes people confused, because sometimes people will believe, which is unfortunate, people will believe a rumor that is extreme more so than ones that are subtle. Because they think, well, who would make that up? It must be true because it's so, wow, you know, what a statement. Who would make a statement like that if it's not true? Everyone, like, who wants to get away with something would make that statement. That's the answer to that question. So there's so much happening here that happens on a small scale that I see, like in my office, with couples, with families, with cult victims, but it happens large scale too, because it just depends upon who's in charge and if they have the need to get away with things and if they know how to confuse the public.
And I think it's also a problem that people are not familiar with many important facts about our world. So talking about Ukraine, it's probably also our mistake that we did not communicate enough maybe with the Americans, the American audience. I think because it seems that many Americans are not familiar with the events of 2014, for example, because it's so far from the US. And with the occupation of Crimea, the war in Donbass, etc. And it makes them vulnerable to these narratives about that Ukraine is also guilty. It's not like victim, it's also aggressor in some sense. And due to the duration of this war, part of the Western public begins to perceive it as distance and also even get tired of news about it. Because like this getting tired of news about the war is like a very popular phrase in Ukraine, people who tired of the war. And of course, we are tired of the war because it's a tragedy. The people, I personally have more than 10 acquaintances who were killed by Russia. And it's not like just about me. So we are living through this, and of course we are also tired of the war, not of news about it. But this getting tired of this news about this distant war makes it easier to promote such populist statements like Ukraine could have avoided the war. And finally, from the psychological point of view, it's important that these narratives are actively disseminated through social media like Telegram, TikTok, X, Facebook. And it's often very emotional, simplified, that are more easily digested by a wide audience, and our official sources usually operate through traditional channels with traditional ways of explanation, etc. And of course, they have less reach and speed. And I think it's also about education, but who is interested in this in educating people? This is a question, because it looks like governments are not interested in this.
No, they're not. They should be, but they're not. I think there's also this way of distracting people, making something about something else, like when Zelensky was meeting in the White House for this. I don't even know where to begin with that meeting, but when there was focus on his clothing, and then that became a subject. It's like here where the subject is about trans athletes. What? Okay, maybe like 0.something% of the population. Really? That's the thing we're going to focus on? And also they're not a threat, but let's stop having it be where the government is like throwing a ball that direction and then we all just follow it that direction, and to notice that that's what's happening. I mean, the comment about Zelensky's clothes was ridiculous on so many levels, but also because American presidents during wartime have worn their non-presidential clothing, Eisenhower, George Washington. So I don't know why he was given a hard time. We have a history of it in our country, but people don't know that. It's exactly like what you're saying. They don't have this frame of reference to know that that's a ridiculous thing to put someone down for. We do that in our own country. And so, how do you keep people's eye on it sort of in the right direction? It seems like it's getting harder to do that. I'm curious about how, as fact checkers, how you help people focus on what they really need to be focused on so they can really see what's happening, and the distraction doesn't work. The rumors don't work because it's very hard. You're fighting against human nature. And a lot of us are followers because of being socialized beings for survival. I mean, it's part of how we developed over time and survived over time over millennia. And so how do you help people see what they need to see?
Now we try to use the technologies also to deliver available all these technologies, all these technological features are available not only for disinformators but also for fact checkers. So we try to reach different audience, different bubbles, collaborating with in some projects. For example, for some audience, one of this project was about reaching the broad audience through national TV channels, prime time news. But you know that now television is losing popularity, especially among younger audiences. So other projects dealing with TikTok, for example, and now I am going to participate in one of such TikTok projects. We have in Ukraine, there are some young population, some young generation, some people who bloggers who founded their TikTok projects, who tell people also about propaganda, about disinformation in simple words. Like in TikTok formats, in this like short videos, it's not our strong side. But I'm going also take part in one of such projects. So why not? I hope it will work. But yeah, now the problem is that all this audience we cannot act as 20 years ago, for example, when we reach TV, for example, through TV, we can reach the most of population. Now it's impossible. Now there are a lot of very, very small, relatively small bubbles where people have completely different information, basic information, because they get this information, get their news from different sources, and these sources are not most often not news media. Most often they are some short videos, TikToks, reels, shorts, etc. For me, it's I don't still believe that it's possible that people don't that people are not interested in some reliable facts. But unfortunately, this is true. So now we try to reach to different audiences where they are. But now we are just looking for the ways to communicate with people. It's like a long way. Maybe there are some ideas how to improve this, but how?
Right. Well, I think it is good to see how much fear is used and how successful fear can be, instilling fear in others, having people see other people not as other people, but as a threat to them. That is a huge motivator to believe then that there's something wrong with those people, or that they need to be kept under control, dehumanizing people, calling them things like animals, vermin, all these things. So if you can dehumanize a person or see them as a threat, like immigrants are taking our jobs kind of thing, right? And so that is very effective. And so it is, I think it's important for people to see that that is being used to cultivate something inside of them that might not be accurate. I think it's also good to find out if you can, although it sounds like it's hard with different propaganda, to find out who is writing it and who they work for, if it's a study, who funded it. You know, I one time was teaching and I gave an example and I just said, "There's, I'm going to make up a study, but this this study has this falsehood in it, a false correlation, which happens too. Like this happened, we have a bad economy because of these people," like just making a connection, not because of the president, but just because of other, because of people.
Yeah, it's very simple, manipulative.
Right.
Just to point some enemy.
Yeah, but to point out the enemy. Right. If you have an enemy, they say that there is nothing as unifying as a common enemy. And so it's true. Like, oh, we have to band together. But when we're busy banding together, maybe let's also know that we need to evaluate if we need to actually be concerned, if we really have an enemy. And so I think it's good to sort of help people have those views, but it's hard. It's very hard to teach people to kind of slow down, to notice the feelings that are being cultivated inside of them. And before they act on it, to step back, to step away and see what's happening, what's being done to them. And is it accurate? That's a very hard thing to do, though. So I don't know how you approach that, you know, even as you're teaching them.
All this phenomena you just counted are very popular, especially during the war. They are very, these emotions like fear, manipulations with fear. This is what Russian propaganda uses both in Ukraine and in the international level. In Ukraine, they tell different stories about very strong Russia with some very strong weapons and a lot of money and so on. So it's also about rumors spreading and spreading through Telegram channels. Telegram is very popular in Ukraine, unfortunately, despite this is Russian, this off owned by this. At least it has ties with Russia. But it's the most popular information source in Ukraine for Ukrainians. More than 18% of percent of Ukrainians get their news from Telegram, and not only from reputable channels of media, for example, but also from some anonymous channels who spread these rumors using fears. Not just fear. There are three main emotions used by propaganda rumors. I mean fear, hope, and aggression. When we talk about fear, it's clear. It's attempts to scare people. For example, at the international level, claims about nuclear threat. It's like leverage for Putin to manipulate with public opinion throughout the world, and also to manipulate governments. Because a lot of government, a lot of politicians and people believe that Putin can use the nuclear weapon. The second one is hope, second emotion, because when people hope for something, it's like wishful thinking. It's for example, in Ukraine, a very popular like wishful rumor plot is about Putin's death. It is circulating in Ukrainian information space more than 10 years now. It's not something new. Yeah, and there is some popular rumor story that Putin died in 2023, and then his corpse was put to the fridge, and now it is in the fridge, and now people throughout the world see fake Putin. He is not Putin. And also, one more most used emotion in propaganda is aggression. It's about some stories which incite aggression between different social groups, for example, like polarization, or undermine trust to some trust in some institutions, in some authorities, in the state itself, etc. So it's like these three emotions are like key to understanding of most propaganda efforts, but how to counteract them. It is a question, yeah, on emotional level, not on, not just logically, because, yeah, it's what we do.
Right. Yeah. And I think also for people to not be afraid of looking at how much their emotions can be used, utilized, and manipulated, and to not see it as a weakness. It just means you're a human being. We don't live in isolation. Also, for our own survival, we impact each other. Evolutionarily speaking, that's been a necessity. If we were living, however many, 1,000 years ago somewhere, and somebody comes running past us like they're being chased, can you imagine just sitting there and continuing to eat or picking berries? You go running too. Like, it impacts you. Like, I don't know what they're running from, but I should probably go where they're going. And so we do that. We impact each other. And if someone seems upset about something or anxious, or their people are turning on each other, now it's good to think, is this real? Is this a way to distract people? Is this a way for us to turn towards each other in aggression or lack of trust so that we don't notice what's happening over there? It is very interesting. I know we're getting close to the end of our time, and I wanted to also ask about not only about what you're teaching and that whole experience, and also anything else that you prepared that you wanted to say, please feel free. But I wanted to kind of honor the children who have been abducted. This is something that not a lot of Americans and the listeners here, just to say, are all over the world. But I can speak for myself here in the U.S. It's not something we've heard a lot about, and it's really a shame that we haven't. And maybe people in other parts of the world have heard more about this. So can you just let us know about what has happened with these children, and is there anything happening for them?
Russia's abduction of Ukrainian children is one of the most serious war crimes committed during the invasion. Thousands of children have been forcibly deported to Russia or occupied territories, often under the false pretext of evacuations or adoptions. Many of them are placed in Russian families, given new names, and subjected to re-education efforts in order to erase their Ukrainian identity. It's how we see it. Who is responsible for this? It's Russia, of course, and especially Maria Lvova-Belova. She is Putin's children's rights commissioner, and her role includes overseeing forced adoptions. She personally boasted about adopting a Ukrainian child herself. Spreading propaganda. She claims that Russia is saving these children from war, when in reality they are being taken against their will. Blocking repatriation efforts, Russia has refused to provide full lists of abducted children or allow independent oversight. And yeah, here the Kremlin's goal is clear: to erase Ukrainian identity and indoctrinate the next generation into the its imperialistic vision. Unfortunately, this is much bigger problem than just creating chaos with some like information. But of course, also the Kremlin uses the tactic of overloading people with crisis, from war atrocities to nuclear threats, etc., etc., and it makes it difficult to focus on any single issue. Of course, Ukraine and the international community are making significant efforts to bring these children back. And one of the key steps in this process was the decision by the International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin and Maria Lvova-Belova. This legally recognizes the forced deportation of Ukrainian children as a war crime and holds those responsible accountable under international law. And also, Ukraine is actively working to repatriate and these children. Hundreds of children have already been returned, but each case requires significant efforts. Parents or volunteers often must travel through neighboring countries, as Russia refuses to return the children directly. And of course, a very important role plays beyond legal and on the ground efforts, plays growing international pressure on Russia. The global community is applying diplomatic and economic sanctions, demanding independent investigations, and they demand the safe return of the children, of the abducted children. And it's extremely important. It's very important to increase these international actions, including legal actions, such as sanctions on those involved in child deportation, also tracking and documenting of these cases, maybe organizing a more neutral party negotiations to safely bring the children home. And of course, public awareness here is crucial. The world must not stop paying attention to this crime. So the more pressure that builds, the harder it becomes for Russia to justify its actions. Yeah, I can share some documentaries with you about these children. Maybe it's also would be interesting. And some links.
Yeah, thank you. And if there's any organization doing something, I'll post links. So thank you for that. And then it's just the beginning. Like if you get these children back, you have to deprogram the programming. I mean, it's a long road.
Some of these children are very strong, despite this is very dangerous. Some of these children are strong enough to protest. Yeah, even being completely dependent on Russians, they organized protests in their let's call it jails. They refuse sing Russian anthems, for example, or like this. Our children are very, very strong, and but it's important to return them to Ukraine.
It's incredible when you hear stories like that. I think about stories I heard about kinder transport during the war and how some children survived. And yes, some are very strong. And it is important also for those children to know they're not forgotten about. And that's why these movements are so important. And it helps give them some strength also to protest, that they know they're not alone, you know? So here, with you teaching, I mean, part of what is important, going back to where our conversation started, because you were talking recently in the conversation about feeling overwhelmed, and that makes a lot of people just tune it out and shut down. It's too much. It's just too much, which I understand. But going back to the, what can I do about it? And you now teaching, helping people of a next generation, hopefully, like this is information they can pass along, you know, to their own friends, family, children, is a really wonderful thing to do for education, for prevention. And sometimes when people say, "What I can't watch the news ever," but I also feel guilty because I need to know what's happening, but then I can't sleep and then I can't function. So one of the things that I tell people is to focus on one thing, just one, the thing that matters to them, that speaks to them, that also they feel like they can do something about or that they care about, and kind of block out the rest if they can, but still focus in on something as opposed to nothing. And so I think part of your teaching is helping with that and also continuing with stopfake.org. And so what have you found? Have you found the people who you're teaching, are they overwhelmed? Do they need assistance in trying to figure out how to care, but still have a life, you know?
Now it's we in Ukraine have extensive experience in this information overloading. First of all, I would suggest setting healthy boundaries with news consumption. Not refusing the news consumption, but set, for example, you can set specific times to check updates. Twice a day, for example, in the morning and in the evening. If something important happens, you will know about it. And so you stay informed without consuming news your entire day. Also, choose reliable sources over doom scrolling. From 3 to 5 trusted news sources, instead of scrolling endlessly through social media. And when you consume quality reporting, it helps you stay informed without this emotional overload. Also, already mentioned that it's important to act, not like shift from passive consumption to action. So it's this feeling helpless is one of the biggest sources of stress. And taking even small actions can reduce this anxiety and restore this sense of control. For example, donate to organizations providing aid, or maybe share reliable information with people, with your circle to combat fake news, or support refugees, for example, or local efforts in your community, or maybe go to protest, maybe. And it's important to regain subjectness. I don't know.
Oh, subjectivity. Yeah, yeah.
Subjectivity exactly. To yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. And last but not least, prioritize your mental and physical well-being. It's very important. There is common metaphor that on an airplane you need to put an oxygen mask on yourself first and only then on your child. The nervous system processes distressing news the same way it processes personal trauma. That's why self-care is essential. It's essential to get enough sleep. It's essential to go for walks or exercise, practice some mindfulness maybe or breathing exercises. And for me also I'd suggest connection with others. It's very helpful. Keeping in touch with friends and like-minded people. This helps not go crazy even in very hard times. Talking about your feelings about the situation, for example, it can help process these emotions and remind you that you are not alone. So it's and the most important for me now, especially in current times, is not surrendering to evil, because the struggle can be difficult. It can be exhausting. But I personally am very supported by the understanding that I am honest with myself, that I have not betrayed myself. So it's important, I think, It's about which Viktor Frankl meant that it's important to do something that makes sense for you. Maybe that's it.
Oh, I feel like I just got a therapy session. Thank you.
We are talking about information, but it's very intertwined.
And to give yourself permission to do self-care, that it's not selfish, it's survival, you know. I love that, not surrendering to evil. Ooh, that is so powerful. It is always so good to talk to you. And I hope we get to talk again. And if you ever have the ability to come out this way, you have a place to stay in California. But you're wise and you are strong and like one of these people who has a gentle soul, but a lot of courage and strength on the outside. And that is a lovely combination. And thank you for sharing your wisdom. And I'm so excited that now you get to have even an additional platform to share your wisdom, not just Stop Fake, but now teaching. So it's fantastic. So thank you, as always. It's a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation. it is a pleasure for me to talk with you.
One more thing before you go. It is always so good to speak with Olga. She is a brave one and smart and has so much to share and is doing such important work. I really loved when she was talking about how there is this kind of emotional manipulation triangle, this idea that propagandists use three things, fear, hope, and aggression, to control and to polarize people. So I would love to get more into that now. When we talk about this triangle, we talk about how I think each part is important and it also intersects. So when we have first, let's take fear to start with. We know that fear is used to create obedience and silence all dissent and to justify also drastic action, which is really the scary part of it, I think, among other things. But for example, okay, let's look at what happened after 9/11. So in the U.S., the government had this, what they called a war on terror. And so the tactic was that the media and government repeatedly warned of imminent attacks. I don't know if you remember these color-coded terror alerts and other sorts of things. And it could be that they were valid and it could be that they were needed, but it could also be that they were a dramatic way of using fear to keep people in position to kind of ready to do battle. The result of this was that the public supported expanded surveillance, the Patriot Act, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also the racial profiling of Muslims, which was horrific. And then we can also see this in other ways, you know, the anti-vaccine disinformation. Yes, there could be vaccines that are not necessary, nor are they safe. But across the board, there has been also woven in disinformation. So the tactic, let's say, is the claim that all vaccines cause a genetic mutation or all vaccines cause some form of infertility or impending death. And the result is that then the fear of it overrides science. People don't necessarily look for proof. people are manipulated then into rejecting all of the public health initiatives that say, please take this. This is going to be safer for you to take than getting anything that you might get if you haven't taken it. But that people already, because they are in fear, are not listening to people who have been given the pulpit, the opportunity, the wisdom, the schooling to be able to teach us that our fears are not founded in truth a lot of the time in this scenario. And then you have the second part of the triangle, which is hope. It's used to inspire, but it also is used to inspire loyalty and sacrifice and a commitment to a cause. So I'm going to go for it. Let's look at Hitler. Hitler's promise of national rebirth. So the tactic was that he promised to restore Germany's glory after World War I and undo the economic collapse. So the result, though, is that many bought into a vision of national pride and prosperity at the cost of civil liberties and also at the cost of mass violence and horrors. There's also, to bring it down to what we often talk about here, cult recruitment. The tactic is, come join us. You'll find purpose. You'll find family, healing, salvation. But the result is that then people seeking meaning or connection become trapped in controlling exploitative systems where they really don't necessarily have meaning. They don't have a sense of purpose. They find out later that their meaning and purpose was to keep the organization going or to feed the ego of the leader. And then you have aggression, the third part of the triangle. So it's used to dehumanize others, to enforce conformity and incite violence, which we've seen. So going across the globe again, Rwandan genocide. The tactic was state-sponsored radio called the Tutsis Cockroaches and claimed they were plotting to kill the Hutus. And so what was the result? Over 800,000 people were killed in 100 days by neighbors incited to act aggressively. And then we also see it here with the far right and far left and the echo chambers online. Social media memes and posts accuse the quote-unquote other side of being evil and brainwashed and enemies of freedom. And what is the result? Outrage. And outrage replaces discussion. And fighting replaces discussion. And people become radicalized, sometimes to the point of violence. So where they intersect, a perfect example is the Capitol insurrection in the U.S. in 2021. The fear part is the election was stolen. The hope part is we can save democracy and take our country back. And the aggression part was fight like hell or we won't have a country anymore. And this blend created something that I think was so emotionally manipulative, so much steeped in propaganda that it sparked a collective action. People really thought they were doing right, they were doing good, that they were protecting our institution while they were destroying it. Thank you again to Olga for all of her work, for helping to make some things clear that have been hazy, that have been murky, that have been in the shadows. And I wish you good luck in the ongoing issue in your country and the lack of safety for you, for your family, for your friends. And we're all thinking about you. Take good care. And to all of you, take good care as well. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.